Welcome to Money Your Way. My name is Jess, and I'll be your host. This podcast is all about empowering women just like you to feel confident when making choices in the world of personal finance. It can feel super confusing and overwhelming when there's unfamiliar lingo and tons of options, so I'll do my best to keep this fun and simple as we learn together. What do you say? Let's jump right in. Welcome to today's episode of Money Your Way. I'm so excited you're tuning in. Today's guest is Chris. He's an alternative investment blogger and an author of Get Off Your Ass and Manage Your Money. I don't even know if I should say ass because it has the dollar signs for us.
That's the title.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. Why you need alternative investments. And so we're going to kind of talk a little bit about that, a little bit about his journey. And I just want to say welcome to the show, Chris. And if you want to share anything else about yourself, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jess. I really appreciate it. And I love your younger audience because as we were talking before we started, you know, there's a couple things that impact how quickly you build wealth. And one of them is when you get started and how much time you have. So the earlier I can reach people, the better it off it is for them. So there's two types of investors, basically, a conventional investor, the people that invest in the stock market through their 401ks, and the alternative investor, which is people like me who invest in everything that's outside the stock market. That's every form of real estate, crypto, notes, private equity, commodities. Think about it as the things you can touch. You know, if you own a mutual fund, you can't touch it. If I own a self-storage facility or single family rental or an ATM machine, I can go touch that. They're real assets. So, but I guess the good news is for most of my life, I was a conventional investor, probably like a lot of your investors are, because that's all they know. That's what they hear growing up, their friends, their family, their parents. Everybody talks about the 401k and mutual funds and the stock market. And that's the way, you know, 90%+ of Americans are. And then I had an event in my mid-40s. I was this conventional investor. I lost a whole bunch of money, and I had a choice. I was either never going to retire, or, you know, I was going to work longer, or I was going to live this very substandard lifestyle in retirement. And so I switched over to alternative investments. I read a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki.
I've listened to that book. Great choice.
which has changed. My story is not unique. His book has changed millions of lives and opened people's mind up about money investing. I read that and I was off to the races. I should probably say some of the numbers, just because, you know, I lost 55% of my net worth when I was 45. Thousands of dollars a month from cash flow. It happened to be a divorce, but it could have been bankruptcy, health-related thing. It could be anything. It happens to men and women. But that was a big deal. And I was on the conventional path. It was just kind of, frankly, it's a very mediocre path anyway. So you're not really gaining traction that quickly. So when you lose 55% of that in your mid-40s, that's kind of a big deal. Some people never recover from that. So I switched over to alternative investments. And in 9 years, I made that up and quit my job, but I'll never have to work again if I don't want to. So that's the power of what you can do in nine years when you're getting all the advantages of alternative investments, which is less taxation, less volatility, and way more returns than you'd ever see in the stock market. So that's the background.
No, that's great. And you mentioned the catalyst of the book. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear, at the time, had you been exposed to anyone else, family, friends, colleagues who were seeking alternative investments, or did you kind of feel like you were the pioneer for your network?
None whatsoever. And the second book that I read of Robert Kiyosaki's was a book called Cash Flow Quadrant. And you're either an E, which is an employee, you're a self-employed person, like you own your own business, but really the business owns you, or you're a big business, which is more than 500 employees, or you're an investor. So I was an E. I grew up with a family of employees, you know, starting a business, owning a piece of real estate, anything. That was nothing that was ever discussed, and money wasn't discussed much anyway. That was the first time. I think that's why it was like a lightning bolt. It was like, oh my gosh, why am I 45 years old? I've never heard this before. This is awesome. How quickly can I go down this path? So, I mean, it was an instant the flip switch, and I was like, okay, I'm going off to the races, right?
Awesome. So I want to dive into that and kind of share what those 9 years looked like. Where did you choose to start in the world of alternative investments? You mentioned so many different types that fall in that category at the beginning. How many have you explored? Do you have a favorite for a certain reason? Let's just take some time into that.
Yeah. So I started where most people start, with a single family rental. And some people become alternative investors by accident. Think of a couple, they get married, they buy their first house, they have kids. Pretty soon the house isn't big enough, and then they move up to the next house. Well, some people go, hey, well, what if we just keep that one and not sell it? And so that's a lot of how some people, or maybe for some reason they can't sell it or whatever. So my situation was, my daughter was about to start her second year of college, and I knew this was going to happen way before she went. I go, she's not going to spend 4 years in the dorm, and I'll be damned if I'm going to pay somebody else's mortgage up there while she's living in their place. So toward the end of her freshman year, when she said, hey, Dad, I'd like to live off campus, I said, okay, we're going to go buy a duplex or a triplex or something up there, and you're going to live in it, and we're going to rent out the rest of it. So it happened to be a duplex and within walking distance of the university. And so that's what she did. So, and it happened to be the time of President Obama's first time homebuyer tax credit. So we were two single people owning the house. And even though she didn't do anything in terms of have anything to contribute, she was on the title. So guess what we got? It was a $12,000 or $15,000 check from the government. And so it was two bedrooms on each side. So she rented one of the bedrooms on her side and rented the other hand. And she did a lot of the property management on site up there. And I did some stuff from 100 miles away. And so she got an education, as well as, a stable and place to live that she kind of controlled, for the next 3 years. And we actually probably owned it for 3 or 4 years after she graduated.
That was just going to be my next question, was after you didn't have your daughter in there, did you keep it? So it's interesting.
Yeah, so it became a little bit of a problem for her, because then she went on to get her master's degree and she was living someplace else. And so she had this problem. She had this big liability, this debt payment, on her credit report, but she didn't have the income to go. So it started to hurt her credit wise and just getting, credit cards and, personal loans and car loans and things like that. So we eventually, I could have bought her out, but it was actually time to get rid of the property and move on to some other things. So
that's great. So that's where you started. Talk about what else happened after that.
Yeah, there were some other, small single families and small, multi units. And I heard some guys on a podcast say once that every once in a while, you should look at all the assets that you own and ask yourself this question: knowing what I know today, would I buy these assets again? And I looked at the financials on all these things that I had and these smallish properties, and I was, is that all the money I made? And I was like, I'm selling them all. So I pretty much cleaned the slate on kind of all what I would call my learning investments. Let's try this. Let's try that. And so I sold them. And now my favorite asset class is apartment buildings, but through a syndication model where I'm just a limited partner, a passive investor, and I'm bringing money to what's called a syndicator, somebody who's an expert at buying these apartment buildings and running them. And I'm just bringing money and I'm getting, this is where it really starts to add up, 25%+ average annual returns, which means every 4 years I'm doubling my money. You're never going to see that in the stock market. And most of that money is tax-free because there's this beautiful thing called depreciation. So think about doubling your money every 4 years and not paying taxes. That's how in a 10-year period, you can really make some significant movement.
So I like to oversimplify everything I hear. And that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that sounds like a Kickstarter version of getting into an apartment complex. So someone has the larger apartment complex vision, right, and that business per se, and then you're contributing a portion to it. Your contributions, my question would be, is that, well, first, did I understand that correctly? And two, are your contributions a one-time thing? Are you committing to a certain amount at a different time frame?
Yeah, so this is a great question, because you're talking about ownership structure, and do you really own that piece of real estate? So think of a So I'm going to use this word syndication again. So if any of your listeners are driving down this street and they see this, 250 unit apartment building, it under construction or in existence or whatever, it's very likely that one person put down the cash to build that or buy it. And what happens is it's done through what's called a syndication, where somebody says, "Hey, I'm an expert at this. I'm going to go buy this thing, and I'm going to invite a bunch of investors to come along with me." And in the way, there's different ways to do this, but in the way that I do it, that is a single company that owns that building, and it's a one-time investment. So the syndicator goes out and says, "Okay, I need, $20 million for the down payment and for some of the initial expenses that I want to have in the bank." And he goes out and raises $20 million from people like me. And that can get down to as little as $25,000. So, because that was, might be your next question, well, how much do you need to have? Well, in some cases, you can get in for as little as 25. And then they run that building. And it could be either a cash flow model where I'm getting a monthly check. The ones I do are typically, it's really not much cash flow. It's just like, okay, over the course of 3 to 4 years, this place is going to be refinanced or sold. And what I like to say is I send my money out and it comes back with twice as many friends 4 years later. And when you actually, in one of these deals, you're an owner, you're a member of that company that owns this, you get what's called depreciation. With the Kickstarter and with things called REITs, REITs, real estate investment trusts, which are sold on the stock market, I know for sure with REIT, you're not an owner of that building. You're an owner of a company that does stuff in the real estate market. So you have to be very careful to make sure that you're getting all the benefits of owning real estate. And one of them is the depreciation, pass your share of the depreciation, and you get the benefit of, even though you didn't go out and get a loan, the syndicator got a loan. So you and your fellow investors put together $20 million, but you own $100 million and you get the benefit of that $100 million building. So I'm not all that familiar with Kickstarter and some of those things because I don't use them, but that's something that you got to be careful to make sure you're actually an owner in the building.
That was really helpful. Yeah, for sure. And as I'm like listening to this, I'm thinking, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but it's like, okay, that person is getting loans, or the syndication itself is getting loans from outside investors. Why do they choose that over the traditional or conventional method of going through a bank?
Well, so in so there's two types of there's kind of two categories of money. One's called equity and one's called debt. Equity is ownership and debt is a loan. So the in the syndicators that I use, I'm bringing equity. I am an owner, and they're getting bank debt. So they could also get debt from private individuals, but most of the time they're getting in the apartment space, they're getting debt that is backed by Freddie and Fannie, these government agencies that back the debt. But to answer your question, it's a if one of the ways that you can make money in alternatives is be a private lender. So, and I have done this, and I could own mortgages. So you go out and buy a house, and you might get the money from the bank. Well, sometimes the banks will sell off those loans, and I could buy it. So I might actually be, and I have been the owner of people's mortgages. And why would I do that? Because I like getting that $1,000 a month, So I'm secured by the value of that house, and if the borrowers don't pay, then I can, take the house and sell it and recoup my investment.
And so back to that same category of having the asset. That's the trend I'm noticing here.
Yeah. Well, with notes, you really own you own a paper asset, right? Because it's the promissory note that you own, and you that you that 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 loan, which is a liability to the borrower, is an asset to you as the lender. But the note is not an unsecured loan like a credit card or a personal loan. It's backed by a real asset, which is that house.
I want to shift and talk a little bit about your book. So,
You mean this book? Oh, we're not on video. I have it right here.
we
Just
are on video.
kidding. Yeah,
The
the
audio
audience
will
isn't
only be on
right.
the
You could tell them. It's a beautiful cover, isn't
Yeah, it's right in your face. You know exactly what it's for.
it?
Who's your audience for the book? Kind of who are you mainly talking to, and What's kind of your argument on against the people who feel so comfortable, like you mentioned, in that conventional stock market 401k world for their investments?
Well, you know, my market is kind of everybody like me, which is, you know, 90%+ of the population who has bought this lie that the way to financial freedom and retirement is by putting your money in your company's 401k or an IRA or just in the stock market and letting some financial advisor take care of your money. So it's a book. It's a large audience. I really like it when I'm in front of audiences like your audience who are younger, because like I said, the sooner you get started, and I need to trademark this term, but I call it being on the 401k highway to mediocrity. And, you know, the interesting thing is I'm going to say something that I will bet only a handful of your listeners have ever heard. A 401k sucks. You should never put your money in one, even to get the matching and tax benefits. It's not worth it. Now, how many people have ever heard that? Probably not any. It's like when Galileo said that the world is round, you know? I mean, they thought he was crazy. So this is kind of the uphill battle. But so what I do in the book is I describe what conventional investments are and what alternatives are. And then I compare them across 13 different categories. And I'll just look at my little sheet here. Things like liquidity and risk and control, tax efficiency, volatility, you know, returns, cash flow, diversification. And there's 13 of them. And in one of them, they're kind of neutral, risk. They both have, every investment has risk. And then in all but one of the other categories, alternatives are better. So they're neutral on one, and then and the other 12, alternatives are better than conventional investments. So why would you invest over there where all these benefits are over here? And I go through each one of those things, those comparison items, and I use one of my investments with real numbers, which is ATM machines. I own ATM machines. And so I talk about generally how it's better, but then I say, and here's a real example that I can share with you about how this works. And, you know, the S&P 500 is the big benchmark index of the U.S. stock market. And since its inception, it has returned somewhere 9-something% to the index has returned. But studies have been done. Well, how did the average investor, what do they actually earn in the S&P 500? Because we're not an index, we're people. We buy in and we trade and we get out and we contribute and we don't contribute. And the average investor made something like 5%. So especially in today's environment, if you're only earning 5%, you're losing buying power, because inflation, real inflation, is over 10%. Mm-hmm. So you're just never gonna, you're not likely. It works for some people, because when you think about investing, you can only invest the money that's above and beyond your expenses. So if your expenses are $10,000 a month and your income is $10,000 a month, you have no money to invest. So let's say, okay, one day you get a raise and now your income is $11,000 a month. Well, that's still only $1,000 a month to invest. Now, if you make $100,000 a month, this is where this system works for people that have really high incomes, because as long as they don't spend everything they make, they have so much money that they can invest. But that's not the average American.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would bet most of my audience is in the hundreds a month range, if they're even investing. I know that's a concept that people are still getting comfortable with. They're navigating the choice of investing over paying down debt, which, if you have thoughts on that, please go ahead and share.
So unlike I won't name them by name, some of the very well-known financial gurus that say you should pay off your house and get out of debt, here's something you can't. And let me define. I want to use this term rich or wealthy, but I want to define what that is, because I know that some people might hear that term and it might have a negative connotation. So here's what being wealthy is. If your expenses are $5,000 a month and you have $5,000 a month of passive income from various investments, now you can make work a choice instead of a necessity. So now You're wealthy. Your time is your own, and you can do whatever you want with it. If you like your job and you want to work, or you want to work for a job that pays half of what you were making before because that's what makes you happy, you know, you have all the choices. So you can't get rich without debt. You know, so in the example of, we'll use an example of the person that makes 10, or they have $10,000 a month of expenses, and they only have an income of $11,000 a month. So that's $1,000 a month. Well, if you buy the right asset, like an alternative asset, like a piece of real estate, a bank, well, you don't need to have the money to buy the whole thing. A bank will loan you 70, 60% of the money to get that asset. And the bank only wants their loan payment. They don't get any of the upside. They don't get any of the, you know, of the tax benefits. And so it doesn't have to be your money. You can use other people's money. And that just magnifies your returns. Now, the problem is it magnifies the downside too if things go wrong. So it's a very, this is a topic that's worth studying. Matching the right kind of debt with the right asset, you know, will make you wealthy. And I don't even, I'm renting now because I just moved from Seattle to South Carolina. So I'm renting for a few years here until I kind of figure out the lay of the land and where the best place to buy is. But in Seattle, I did a cash out refi on my house to get as much money out of it as I could, so I could take that money and invest it in a cash flowing self storage unit. And then I refinanced my house again to an interest only mortgage. I don't really care if I ever pay off the loan. Whether I have a loan or not doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is I have enough monthly cash flow to take care of all my obligations. And we're in a little bit different time now. You know, when I was saying before that I'm routinely making 25% average annual returns on these apartment buildings. So why would I pay off? Why would I take money that could be going into that return and pay off a fixed term mortgage at 3%? That's not a good financial. There's something called opportunity cost, right? So that's not a good financial move. Now, there's a psychological thing here when it comes to your primary residence, which I won't argue with. If owning your home outright and not having a mortgage payment gives you peace of mind and makes you sleep at night, that's great. Do it all day long. But financially, that's not a smart move. But I can't argue with, you know, everything's not about money, right?
So. Right. There's the logic and the emotion, like the the two different people sitting on your shoulders around a lot of money conversations. Well, yeah. I appreciate that, you know, perspective that you brought. You mentioned the ATM now twice, and I've actually seen somewhere else that someone shared their story of getting involved in, which I think would qualify as an alternative investment in vending machines. And I thought when I saw that, that was really interesting. And then you mentioned ATMs, which I didn't even realize like weren't necessarily only owned by the bank. So something in that realm, where do you even know where to start? Is this just, hey, everything's in Google and you spend a couple hours looking things up? I mean, you've gotten experience now to test a whole bunch of different areas of alternative investments. The real estate one seems most familiar, I think, to a lot of people. But now we're getting into the area of like, what do you do there? I don't even know someone who has that kind of conversation. Right.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was because alternatives are harder and you need to have more financial education. We don't know about this stuff. Somehow you have to learn it. And it doesn't come from watching CNN and MSNBC. You're never going to most likely never see this stuff here. So you have to put yourself into a, you know, into a different world. So what I did with the book is I thought, look, my path over 10 years was kind of one step forward, two step backs, three steps to the left. What if I could draw a straighter line for people so that people who wanted to do this could do it more efficiently and less mistakes? So after I try to convince people why alternatives are better, then I talk about what is the path to get there. And it's really an education path. There are books you need to read. There are podcasts you need to listen to. You need to start attending, you know, different meetings. You should travel to different places in the country and go to different meetings because there are people who have done this before. And you need to start hanging around with people who are already where you want to be. you know, and let these people be your mentors and your coaches. And in the book and on my website at theprolificinvestor.net, I've got, you know, I list books that I've read and podcasts that I'm listening to and syndicators that I'm using. And there's another great resource that I almost forget. And this is a group that I belong to, and I don't gain anything other than goodwill. It's called Left Field Investors, and that's at leftfieldinvestors.com. And they're all about passive investing. And that is a great, there's a portion that you can join for free. And the really expensive portion is like $99 a year. I recommend anybody who wants to join this, do that. So there's a whole kind of, you just got to get your mind in a different place. And that's going to take a little bit of time.
Oh, thank you. No, of course. I'm going to close out unless you had anything else you wanted to share. And I will ask you my closing question. What is one permission slip you'd like to leave the listener? And it could be related to our conversation today or just something else you feel is on your heart.
I would say it's okay to not know everything and ask questions. You know, I think people, I think a lot of times once people leave the formal education environment of high school, college, graduate school, whatever, they stop pursuing education. And education doesn't have to be in the formal classroom. All the things that I talked about, you know, when I'm getting up in the morning and taking a shower, guess what I'm doing? I'm putting new information into my brain. And that's how, so I would say, just don't be afraid to learn. Don't be afraid to ask questions. I found most people in this space to be so happy and willing to help other people. So.
And with that, I think I'll just give a shout out to the listeners. Like, if you are listening to this, you're already taking one of those steps. So definitely pat yourself on the back for that and keep going. Well, Chris, I want to give you opportunity to share how people can stay in touch with you. You shared your website. Feel free to say it again. I'll link it in the show notes and then where your book is available and anything else there may be.
Yeah, I'll make it real simple. Everything's at theprolificinvestor.net. So there's a place to link you to the book on Amazon. There's a coffee cup. So if you want to have a free virtual coffee with me, a video conference for 30 minutes, I open my schedule on Thursdays to do that. And you're trying to get started or you're already started and you want to ask me some questions. You know, it's always nice to be able to, you know, talk to somebody one-on-one as opposed to having information, you know, pushed at you. So yeah, everything's and all the social media handles, everything's at theprolificinvestor.net.
I love that little coffee idea too. Yeah. Thank you. I'll make sure that that's all linked. And again, really appreciated this conversation. This was fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to Money Your Way. If you loved this episode or you learned something new, it would mean the world to me if you just took a few seconds and shared it with a friend. I cannot wait to keep learning and growing in this journey together.